Welcome you all to this first edition of The Future is Now with our guest Anne Applebaum.
Thank you. Thank you.
10 years ago, the idea that fake news and disinformation might become a problem for Western nations seemed to be very far-fetched. But today, it has become one of the major issues that is challenging our democracies. As Anne Applebaum has written in one of her recent essays, and I quote, "These messages, fake news messages, are no longer seen just by a small fringe, but they are much more likely to be consumed by mainstream users of social media. At the same time, only a tiny percentage of political information available on social media actually comes from political candidates. People are now much more likely to see a targeted ad from an unidentified political group with an opaque agenda, in other words, than something written by people actually vying for their vote." End of quote. Exploring the relation between information, the exchange of opinion, and political discourse is therefore very urgent and of vital importance. As this kickoff event of The Future is Now, we examine the status of disinformation or information and the implosion of trust in our democratic institutions. How can we prepare ourselves for this post-fake news age? And Applebaum, I will introduce her very short, but she will introduce herself afterwards, is an Atlantic columnist, a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, a professor of practice at the London School of Economics, and she's a renowned expert in the research and analysis of propaganda and polarization, and the impact this has on our social and political community. My name is Daan Rovers. I'm a philosopher, a thinker laureate, and the moderator of this evening. We will have a conversation for, I think, 1.5 hours, but you, the audience, will have can jump in as well. But I think in 3/4 of an hour, I will give you a sign, and then please raise your hand, and there will come a mic to you. And then please stand up, because this evening is live streamed, and then you not only be heard, but also be seen by the audience. You came from Britain by train today. Is this the first time you crossed the border in this post-Brexit age, or?
Actually, on the day of Brexit, I flew into London from Germany, and I forgot to take a photograph, you know, of the you are now EU people only this way. I have to know, nothing's happened yet, so I'm afraid it was very unexciting.
You didn't notice any
No
changes?
Guards at the borders, no guard no dogs,
Texas,
no
tax-free
guns.
Tax-free shopping, yeah. No.
Nope, nothing. Nothing changes until next year, and it might not even change then, so.
I think we'll come to talk about the Brexit in a minute, but first, a few things about your background and your expertise. You're a historian, a journalist, a researcher, and I think you have three homelands, United States, Britain, and Poland.
I'm a citizen of NATO.
Citizen of NATO, yeah. But these are all strongman politics countries, aren't they?
I mean, you know, we're heading that way in all of our countries. But yes, you could say these are three countries that have experienced a particular version of the modern democratic crisis already. Yeah, that's true.
And you, since 2014, you're the director of ARENA, a research institute that's part of the London School of Economics, and that's analyzing...
It's a project. Research institute makes it sound like a huge thing. It's actually a small project, but yes.
Please tell us a little bit about it, what you're doing there, and what your aim is.
Okay, so first of all, thank you. I haven't said thank you, and how much I'm delighted to be here, and how much I like being in Amsterdam. I was just saying on the way in that the aesthetics of Amsterdam always appealed to me, and I love the symbolism of the hidden church. ARENA was originally a think tank project, and then we moved it to the London School of Economics, and it was created by me and a colleague, friend, Peter Pomerantsev. And both of us were simultaneously in kind of 2013, 2014, we both became aware at the same time of a new form of Russian propaganda that was working in a different way from the way it had worked in the past. And we come from completely different backgrounds. My background is that I spent many years writing books about the Soviet Union and Soviet communism, and so I had that in the back of my head. And Peter had been a television producer in Moscow, actually. He's a kind of Russian-British. He grew up in Britain but has Russian origins. And he'd worked in entertainment television in Russia from during the first part of the 2000s. And he had watched the creation there of a new kind of information state, really. And he wound up writing a book about it called Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, which is a very good title. And my original encounter with Russian propaganda, as I was just telling you, was the awareness that it was directed at me. And I won't go into all the details, but I had an odd experience with a series of articles that were written about me that I noticed appearing in lots of places in what I realized was a kind of was a set of websites that had been created for the purpose of passing around stories. This one was a claim that I had implied that I was being secretly paid by mysterious people. Maybe it was the CIA, maybe it was the Polish government, maybe it was the Ukrainian government. And, you know, it passed around all these odd websites, and then eventually...
He was subject of this.
I was the subject. Yeah, I was the subject of it. And eventually, the original article, which had originally appeared on kind of Russian business website, was retweeted by Julian Assange. And this was before the WikiLeaks involvement in the U.S. elections. I had also become aware of how pro-Russian political groups and organizations and businesses were operating in different European countries, and so we started out thinking about Russia. Honestly, that was the original project. And for me, of course, the fascinating thing was trying to understand what was different about the modern Russian use of information, how it was different from the old Soviet use. And there are some consistencies, but there are some differences created by modern technology. In the olden days, the Soviet Union's main aim was to convince people to like the Soviet Union. You know, they remember the posters with, our tractors have achieved 150% of the plan, and our society's better than your society. It was a kind of competition with the West. Modern Russians don't care if you like them. I mean, the Russian government. Lots of ordinary Russians care, but... the Russian government doesn't care if you like them. The point of Russian propaganda today is to divide and distract the West with the ultimate goal of undermining democracy. And they're not trying to be popular, they're trying to, and they don't promote themselves. They use all the modern tools of disinformation, ranging from bots and fake websites and kind of organized campaigns, to try to support extremist movements, actually of the far right and the far left, in most European countries. So the original project was just an analysis of that, and then when we moved it to the London School of Economics, we became much more technical, and we began producing papers that looked very specifically at particular elections, again, originally at Russian involvement. More recently, particularly as I think we can all see that the tactics that the Russians invented are used by many others.
Is it a coincidence that the greatest social media disinformation experts are also experts on the Soviet Union?
I think it's just because we became paranoid before anybody else did. We're used to it. First of all, they attacked us, So we, the other big turning point moment for all of us was the invasion of Ukraine, first the invasion of Crimea and then of Eastern Ukraine. And this was important because for me, it was a very strange experience because I wrote a book about the Soviet invasion of Eastern Europe after at the end of the Second World War and how the Red Army came into Eastern Poland and Eastern Hungary, and they, of course, when they arrived, they often wore these unmarked uniforms. They pretended to be Polish. They created kind of fake Polish communist parties, which were actually peopled by or run by Russians. They created all these fake entities and organizations, and they denied that what they were doing was an invasion or an occupation. No, it's a liberation. We're liberating these countries. And when I watched on television the Russian action in Crimea, and you know, it was like a kind of a light bulb went off. I mean, this was exactly the same kind of operation. You know, they you know, it was people in unmarked uniforms, and they said we're liberators. They implied that probably they were separatists. Revolting against the new government in Kiev. And to me, it was I almost felt like I wish I had seen this happen before I wrote my book, because then I would understand better how this operation worked. And of course, they also put out this propaganda, which was very successful in parts of the West. You know, people said, well, is this a Russian invasion, or are these separatists? You know, maybe there has been a coup in Kiev, and maybe this is a legitimate intervention. And there was a lot of confusion for many weeks, in cities like this one and in Washington and New York. And it was fairly clear to me, from the beginning, that this was a Russian operation and that it was accompanied by a propaganda campaign designed to cover up what it was. And then eventually, with time, it became clear, and Putin gave medals to the invaders, so, you know, because we now know that they are the Russian army. But the way it worked, and anybody who'd been paying attention to Soviet behavior over the, Russian behavior over the previous decade, had seen this kind of thing happening before. They created a political crisis in Estonia over a Soviet era statue. You know, they'd been working on creating these kinds of crises and doing messaging and information around them for a long time. So, but Ukraine was this kind of moment of crisis, and so that I think is why so many of us got drawn into it.
Yeah, because you were more suspicious about this Russian propaganda. You were trained
to see this information. It's not so much that we were suspicious, it's just that it all looked very familiar. Yeah. You know, where have I seen this kind of behavior before?
Well, maybe we should...
Even though it's not the same, not exactly the same.
We talked about a very well-known example in Holland, in our country, namely the MH17 flight.
No, this was an amazing story.
Yeah. And you analyzed that as well.
We wrote something about that. The MH17, the Russian reaction to the MH17 accident. Well, it wasn't an accident. It was shot down by what we now know were actually ordinary Russian troops. They weren't even the Ukrainians, this fake separatists. The reaction was very interesting. The Russian government didn't deny it. Instead, they put out 100 different stories about it. It was the Ukrainians who shot it down. It was the Americans who shot it down. There was one version that there was a plane that was deliberately filled with dead bodies in Amsterdam. It was taken up into the air and then exploded on purpose to embarrass the Eastern Ukrainian separatists, fake separatists. And literally dozens and dozens of these stories. And of course, the impact of that, when there's so many stories and it's so confusing, was to make people feel that, well, we just can't know what happened. It's impossible to tell. And there was a very, very good sort of mini documentary done by, I think it was done by Radio Liberty a few weeks after this happened. And they went around Moscow and they asked people on the street who shot down that plane. And the answer people gave was, not only do we not know, we will never know. It's impossible to find out. The truth will never be known. And this was the effect of this multiple confusing, narratives. It convinced people that the truth is something that can't be known. And if the truth can't be known, then that means that the dictatorship, the government, can create the truth. And this is the ultimate aim of this kind of propaganda. It's to eliminate even the idea that we can know what's true. Very, very similar kind of behavior happened after the murder of, the attempted murder of Sergei Skripal, this KGB agent in Salisbury in England. Yeah. It was a very similar, once again after that, the British Foreign Office was actually keeping track, and I think at one point they were up to 40 or something different explanations for it. Again, put out 1,000 different messages, confuse people, undermine reality, convince them that they, not just that they don't know what happened, but they will never know, and it's not possible to find out.
So this is the perfect model for online disinformation, that you create so much junk information that you
Yes.
Drown people in information so you destroy the whole idea of the truth. It's not about lying, it's about destroying
yes.
the idea of the truth.
Yes, and then if nobody knows what's true, then you know, then you can, as I said, you can manufacture reality in the way that you want. And people will either accept it or say, well, we don't really know, and they can't criticize. I mean, this is one of the reason why not just Putin, but also President Trump and others who you've called strongmen are so vehement about attacking media, universities, you know, any place that might be a source of objective information. And this event is not an event that's making excuses for the media and for universities, which have lots of flaws. But the viciousness of the attack on those kinds of institutions is because they want to eliminate sources of objective reality and replace it with their own.
And this was one part of your expertise, is Soviet Union knowledge, but you're also a historian. So how come a historian be involved with these online information and disinformation? Does your historical background give you some insight or some...
So first of all, for me, history and journalism aren't that different. I mean, they're both essentially an attempt to gather facts and put together the story as well as you can. It's just that, you know, in journalism, you have to do it much faster and you're much more likely to be wrong. And you don't have the benefit of hindsight. You don't know what's going to happen next. So there, it's a little bit different, but it's not so wrong. And the interest in disinformation really grew out of both. I mean, it grew out of being interested in how propaganda had worked in the past, which is one of the subjects of my books, and an awareness of how again, we began with the Russians, but this is absolutely not about Russia anymore. But being aware of how it functioned in the present, and then being interested in trying to understand it better and think about how to overcome the problem. I mean, one of the conclusions that we came from, and maybe this is what you were going to ask me next, is that
conversation's going very well.
No, at a deeper level, you know. So, you know, why does this work? I mean, one of the reasons it works is because the whether it's Putin or whether it's Trump or whether it's, you know, political parties and leaders in other places, they succeed in successfully polarizing societies and in convincing at least some people that, you know, all of the mainstream institutions, the media, the judges, the courts, the parliament, can't be trusted because they've been captured by the other side. I don't know whether they're traitors or elites or whatever it is. And so ultimately, it disinformation works on very polarized societies. And so that led us to our next set of projects, which was looking at polarization, how it works, how you can you smooth it? Can you ease it? Can you, you know, are there ways that you can work with people to reduce it? And that's kind of where we are now.
Well, I want to ask you about polarization, but the question about history was also about historical parallels. And I think in one of your articles, you drew a parallel between this age and the age when the
invention of the printing press.
The printing press, yes, yes, and the consequences it had.
So this is another important piece of the story. So as I said, we began by being interested in Russia, but eventually you also come to realize that, you know, the very nature of modern media, not just social media actually, but modern media, has changed.
What do you call modern? What's modern media?
Modern media, contemporary.
Is it mass media? Let's
call it the internet.
Okay.
You know, the
digital media.
No, the digital, the way in which people now get and process information, and especially political information, is totally different from what it was 20 years ago. There's been an enormous revolution. Partly it is to do with social media, which is, you know, you all know now, everybody knows that it's, which tends to create filter bubbles because people get information from their friends and from people they trust. It's also to do with the decline of the so-called mainstream media, the decline of, fact-based reporting, the weakness of the financial model that no longer supports press. It's to do with, I think, even the way in which people get news. I mean, most of us get it now on our phones, you know, in which you kind of flip through and there's an ad for hair dryers and there's an ad for, something about a pop music that I like, and then there's something about a political party, and it all kind of runs together, and it seems the same, and there's no There's no hierarchy of importance, if there ever was. And this transformation has a parallel in almost every time in history when there have been major changes in the way in which people get information, there have been big political changes that have gone with it. And the most famous example of this is the moment of the invention of the printing press, which did all kinds of useful and wonderful things. You know, it increased literacy and it gave people access to books and knowledge in a much cheaper way. And it undermined the dominance of the monasteries and, you know, which had controlled, you know, the production of books had been a very expensive and time-consuming thing before. And one of the side effects was also the Reformation, which I know maybe some people in this room are happy about and some people aren't, but certainly the people who used this building were. Right. Yep. But, you know, the Reformation also led to, you know, 100 years at least of religious warfare in Europe and very bitter divisions and conflicts that went on, you know, for many decades. And we are in a moment like that, where the mainstream institutions have been, can be challenged and written about in new ways, and we may be in for a period of very rapid change and conflict. The other interesting moment, if you look at, is the invention of radio. And radio is also transformational.
100 years ago, I think.
Approximately, yeah. And the first people to really learn how to use radio and to understand how radical it'd be were Hitler and Stalin. I mean, Hitler understood that if he was speaking inside somebody's house and he could reach them directly, then it was much more powerful than reaching them through the printed word. And actually, many modern institutions were created as a response to the to the power of radio. I mean, famously, the BBC was very consciously actually created as a project. You know, the British said, right, you know, we have this new medium, you know, it could divide people. What we want is a public broadcaster that can unite people. And so the BBC was conceived as something that would reach all social classes. It would have, you know, Scottish and Northern Irish and even and local branches so that it would reach people in provinces. And it was thought of as a forum for public debate, you know, that what we need to make sure that we have in this new world is a place where democracy can continue, you know, where we can all talk, at, you know, and exchange views, so that people don't wind up in echo chambers, and that was the thinking of the BBC at the time. And of course, we are now at a moment when, once again, one of the effects of new media is that it splinters people, and particularly, actually, in two of the countries that I feel loyal to, one being Poland and one being the United States. You see the effect of this very bitter division. You know, and in fact, in the United States, there is no one television channel where everybody will appear and every political actor is comfortable being there. And there is no one studio or one space that everybody accepts as legitimate. You know, so there's the Fox News space and then there's the CNN, MSNBC space. And, you know, one group of people won't appear on one and vice versa. And that has created, you know, that means that we have there's a real democratic deficit. There isn't a shared culture anymore. There isn't a shared political culture. It's very deeply divided. But this is an effect that we've seen before. I mean, it's not the first time that our societies have experienced this kind of division.
So the BBC was the public answer to this.
It was.
Propaganda machine that radio was, yeah. But now BBC still exists, but there's a big divide in Britain as well, I think.
So the BBC is in trouble, and part of the reason it's in trouble is because it's perceived on both sides of the political spectrum now, actually, as having been captured by the other side. You know, it's no longer thought to be, you know, neutral, and people are angry at it. You know, maybe they've always been a little angry at it, but you know, it's a thing people love to hate. But it's much, much bitterer now, and there is a possibility that the current British government might make big changes to it. They're talking about lifting the license fee. This is something that everybody pays automatically. The BBC has a sort of its own tax base, and they're talking about changing that. And that will be an important turning point. I mean, that might be the end of it.
And this... Now we're talking about Britain and the Brexit. In the Brexit article you wrote a week ago, I think, you said the Brexit campaign was transformed from a fringe eccentricity into a movement by a handful of people who decided to make it an argument about identity. But what triggers me is this, in the digital public sphere, you can, a fringe movement can emancipate to a mass movement in
absolutely. No, that's the big change. Very small numbers of people can now get mass audiences, which was not the case before. And that, again, I'm describing this neutrally. I mean, there are many good things about that, and there are bad things about it too. It's not a criticism. It's just a fact that
but we should be very aware of this.
Yeah, no. I mean, the kind of person who used to write, you know, letters in green ink to journalists, you know, complaining about their coverage, can now have, you know, his own website and his own YouTube channel and can reach, you know, very large audiences. And again, you can. There are positive and negative aspects to this, but I mean, one of the reasons why politics is undergoing such a big revolution in so many places is excluded voices, extreme voices, far right, far left, minorities, again, both good and bad, are able to make a bigger impact than they once could.
And then you talk about polarization in your own country, but also in other countries. You say it's not only a clash of opinions, but it's also not sharing the same facts or sharing the same
yes. No. Again, if you look at American politics, Americans literally have two different sets of facts. Like one group of people knows that one set of things happened, and another knows that another. In other words, if you looked at how people wrote and spoke about impeachment, which just ended, the failed attempt to impeach Trump, you know, you can get a completely different explanation of what it was and what happened by reading different sets of media. And again, this isn't just a sort of opinion whether it was good or bad. This is a fundamental disagreement about what was happening and about the original facts of the story.
And how can you work with that as a journalist with these two very distinctive views, with these war of opinions?
This is a interesting debate in journalism, which is, you know, is it your role to depolarize society, or is it your role to write what you think is happening? In other words, what are you supposed to be doing? And there, people have taken different views. I mean, I'm somebody who tries to keep writing about what I see. I have a friend, though. Here's one solution that a friend of mine had. She's a journalist based in Texas, and she did a trip down to the border during one of the heights of the crises when the Trump administration was putting children in these camps. Yeah. And she went with a friend, or no. An acquaintance who was an evangelical Christian. And she wrote the story from the point of view of her friend, who's an evangelical Christian. And she did that on purpose because she wanted the story to reach people who would be more likely to sympathize with the evangelical mm-hmm. Christian than with her, she's sort of an ordinary journalist, but she thought that telling the story with this, you know, with somebody else's point of view would make it more powerful. Whether that worked or not, I don't know. But these are some of the kinds of ideas that people are experimenting with mm-hmm. and trying to test. You know, what are the messages that can reach both sides? You know, are there ways of writing that are more or less polarizing? I mean, one of the projects that we did more recently, we worked with the Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera, partly because I have a good old friend of mine was the deputy editor there, and they actually gave us access to their Facebook page and to the sort of the data analytics piece of the Facebook page, which we watched for a year. And we, at their request actually, because we asked them what's the most polarizing issue in Italy, and they said migration. And so for about a year, we measured people's responses to different kinds of articles. And there were a number of interesting things that we learned, and the most interesting actually was that as the migration numbers actually went down, which they did because of various deals that the EU did to stop people coming over across the Mediterranean. As migration went down, the interest and anger about migration went up. And this was due almost entirely to the sort of information war waged by Salvini. I mean, it was due to his speech and his commentary was creating by itself. In other words, that was him speaking, which had nothing to do with the actual numbers of migrants. So it was, you know, that was what people were reacting to rather than something they were seeing, you know, around themselves. And that was very interesting. But the other piece of it that was interesting, we tried to look at, you know, if you wrote one, the same facts in a different way, and Corriere was very extremely kind, and they did this experiment. So the same story told in different ways with different mm-hmm. headlines and so on. How did people react? And one of the things that we learned actually is that the least polarizing way of telling the story was literally just to report the news. Here's what happened yesterday. You know, the prime minister said X, the minister of interior said Y. That's it, you know. And that didn't upset people. When you tried to humanize stories, so there were a lot of human interest stories, you know, this migrant and his life and how he got to Sicily, and so, you know, this made people more angry. In other words, it was the assumption people would make, which is that, you know, I don't know, feature journalism and narrative stories would reach people, and it actually didn't work.
But I think, did you also investigate or research how much it was clicked on? Because
it was, yes, I mean, it was about how much it was clicked, but it was also about what people wrote under it.
Yeah.
You know, this was a very, and I should say, this was a very kind of primitive experiment, and you can't, you know, actually one of the conclusions that we've come to is that measuring emotion online is very misleading. Yeah. I mean, people will do and say things online that they wouldn't do in real life. It's very hard to know whether people's online personas are the same as their real personas, and even whether people are radicalized by being online because everybody's so angry. Probably not here in the Netherlands.
I'll tell you afterwards. but
it's very hard to know whether what you're seeing is real, you know. But this was just a test experiment. You know, can we? And we did it with a group of Italian computer scientists who were very interested in trying to also figure out if there's a way to measure polarization. Can you measure it? Can you estimate it? Can you look at what makes it more or less? And it was a little inconclusive. I mean, one would have to do it several more times and in different ways to find out whether it.
But you would advise journalists to stick to the facts more and not to.
I mean, it depends on the context, and it depends what you're trying to do. I mean, this was looking at journalism as a way of increasing or decreasing polarization, and that's not what all journalism is for, you know. So this was just a kind of experiment, not even a full experiment.
You're on Twitter as well.
Sorry?
You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter. Sorry, yeah.
And about polarization. Speaking about polarization, yeah, but don't you get depressed on Twitter?
I mean, I'm sort of ambivalent about Twitter. I find it really useful because it sort of, you know, it curates the news for me. In other words, the people I want to read, I can always read what they've written. And I do try to. I follow the far right and the far left. You know, I follow all kinds of people who aren't, you know, who I don't know or necessarily like. And I find it useful way to see what's going on. I mean, but I'm aware that it's not the real world. I don't know, there's something that's happened to me, maybe others feel the same way in the last couple of years. I mean, you know, you can say almost anything about me and I don't care anymore. I mean, it's, you know, just block them. You know, I don't know, maybe other people, everybody's developed this kind of thick skin. Maybe that's bad. Maybe there's something inhuman about it, but many people I know who are active online or who have a lot of followers, and you know, it just somehow washes off after a while, and it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, you have to
really cares, and I try not to argue with people on Twitter. I mean, I just use it to post things and you know read what other people have said. I don't, you know, it's not a very good place. I mean, if you want to have a serious conversation about anything, you don't have it on Twitter. You know, you have it in a room like this one.
Yeah. I want to elaborate a little bit about the intricate link between information and democracy, because disinformation is one thing, but it's also a threat to our way of living and our institutions, I think. And I have a quote from Walter Lippmann, your Pulitzer Prize-winning colleague, one century ago. And he said, he called it the original dogma of democracy. And he said, knowledge needed for the management of human affairs and democracy comes up spontaneously from the human heart. He says, we underestimate all what's needed to live in a democracy. People need information, people need patience, people need engagement.
Well, democracy is based on an assumption of rationality. In other words, there is a kind of mythic, it's based on the assumption that people will get facts and then make their political decisions, based on those facts, and the assumption is that there'll be a kind of competition of ideas, like a marketplace of ideas, and that the best ideas will win, and that people will choose, good leaders because they have good information and so on. I mean, that's always been a little bit of a myth. Let's not fool ourselves. But it is true that in a world where, there is no, when we may be moving towards that world where there is no trusted sources of information, and therefore there are no shared facts, and there is no shared public sphere where we can all at least agree on like what happened yesterday, then it does become hard to see how you have democracy. I mean, how do you, if one group of people, one group part of society thinks that the other part of society are traitors, and that everything they say is a lie, and that the institutions they believe in are false or fake, or, then yes, it becomes hard to have political, it does assume the existence of a kind of shared public space, that we, at the very least, we all agree on the rules, right? We agree how someone should be elected, we agree, what rule of law means, we agree how the courts should work, and so on. If that becomes, people, begin to doubt that, then yes, it becomes harder and harder to see how we can continue to, in the United States right now, we are at a stage where, parties, one party considers the other party illegitimate, and both parties have some faults. And this is not a political argument, but there was a recent governor's race in Kentucky, in which the loser took a long time. I mean, I think it was 9 or 10 days to concede. This is a Republican, on the grounds that the winner was a traitor and he was he'd cheated and so on. I mean, there was no evidence for that, but he seems to have been genuinely convinced that there was. And that may become more and more frequent. I mean, if the losers don't accept the result of a democratic election, then it becomes hard to see how we're going to continue all living in peace with one another. I mean, to be very blunt about it.
But it requires a lot of trust in press or in education institutions.
There is, there is an assumption at the very least of trust in the institutions, that we respect our courts, that we don't automatically assume that the prime minister is a traitor. There is a kind of base of assumption that does need to be there in order for the system to function. And a few very basic things. I mean, the winners cannot seek to eliminate the losers. In other words, there has to be the possibility for political change. So it can't be the case that when one side wins, they rig the system so the other side can't ever win again, which is what we now see happening in some European countries. And it has to be the case that the losers allow the winners to rule without protesting and, trying to use violence against them, for example. And if we begin to lose those basic assumptions, then it's harder to see how the system continues as it does, as in the past.
Alessandro Barrico, an Italian writer, stated in an article that yes, we're Italians, we know about populism, we already live in that for 10, 20 years. We know about having no independent media anymore, and the next step will be, mind you, Americans and the rest of Europe, the undermining of the school system, the trust in school teachers. That's what he foresees in the next step.
Not a coincidence, actually, that Italy has had a big problem. It's getting a little better now, but it has had a big problem in the past with the anti-vax movement.
Yeah.
And they've had a lot of trouble convincing people that the medical establishment is legitimate. And they had not just anti-vax, but also you know, sort of fake medicines and other, you know, it's been a perennial problem that people don't trust the doctors. They don't trust the medical establishment. You know, they're lying to us. They're trying to poison our children, whatever the version of it is. And there've been a huge campaign actually against the anti-vax movement in Italy, and I think the situation's improved. But none of these things can be taken for granted anymore. You know, that people will trust the schools, that they'll trust the universities, that they'll trust the medical establishment. I mean, once you don't trust, you know, the leaders of the country, then why should you trust any of the other institutions of the country either?
Please explain the link for us between the anti-vax movement and the Russian trolls, because there is a link. And then I'll ask the audience if they have some questions.
So there is a link. I have a friend who's working on that project and who's trying to trace that. And I can't tell you right at this second. But yes, there is some evidence that there have been Russian-backed trolling operations that seek to promote the anti-vax movement because it's one of the things that undermines social trust and because it's disorienting. I mean, and there is a link between the anti-vax movement and some forms of extreme politics.
With extreme politics,
just
alt-right?
Whatever. Either the far right or the far left.
Whichever
group it is in a given society who believe that the rest of the mainstream is the conspiracy and is conspiring somehow against them and their children. Because that's what the anti-vax movement is about. It's that they are they're lying to us about these vaccinations and they're designed to harm our children.
Yeah. Okay, I'll look around and see if there's someone in the audience who wants to pose a question. Ah, there's someone. Please, there's a mic coming to you.
Thank you. The book, Why Nations Fail, referred to the failure of institutions and the success of institutions in the promotion of a good state. Do the tactics that you describe necessarily imply the failure of institutions and by implication the failure of states?
Something about the echo means that I didn't quite hear what you said.
Sorry. So
the last part.
Do the tactics you describe necessarily imply the failure of institutions and therefore the failure of states?
I mean, if we can't figure out a way to, you know, to compensate, then yes. I mean, I think the failure of democratic institutions will lead to the failure of the state. So I happen to have just come back from Venezuela, where I was last week. And we might not want to go off on this tangent, okay, but this is a society, and you know, yes, the, you know, Chavez was a Marxist and so on, but he was also somebody who very systematically sought to undermine the institutions of what was Venezuela's democracy. And, you know, one by one, I mean, again, it was the same thing, the elites, the media, the universities, which are under assault right now, the courts and so on. And the effect has been the destruction of the state. I mean, it is heading to what was the wealthiest and one of the most successful countries in Latin America is heading towards becoming a failed state. And so, yes, I think that once you undermine the institutions that keep society together and ensure the rule of law ticks over and ensure that we have regular changes of government, then you are very much in the realm of becoming a failed state.
Are there other questions at this moment? Please go. Stand up.
Oh, yeah. So recently, Facebook was criticized for not policing political ads that might have untruths in them. And there's been an argument that, oh, well, maybe we don't want an entity like Facebook, you know, arbitrating truth. Where do you stand on that?
I don't want Facebook deciding what we see at all, actually. I mean, I don't want the most important decisions about what Americans and everybody else actually reads or doesn't read being decided by Facebook. I mean, I think it's a deeper problem than just kind of censorship of ads. I mean, no, of course I don't want them to be censors. But I also don't want them to, to have such an important role in shaping what news people read. And that maybe gets us to a, you know, the deeper question of whether Facebook has too much power. I mean, that's a different issue from, you know, so no, I don't think they should be deciding. At the same time, I don't want them deciding about, you know, I don't want them to have as much power over what information we get as that they do. We also, you remember, they decide what we see based on a set of algorithms which are secret. And we have no, as a democratic society, we have no access to the algorithm. And whether or not it's a good algorithm or a bad algorithm, you know, we don't know. I don't think that's a state of affairs that we will want to have go on indefinitely.
Yeah, this relates to a question Marietje Schaken sent to me. She would definitely be here if she wasn't in Stanford today. But she's a former member of the European Union. And
European Parliament. We're all members of the European Union.
Yeah. No, not all.
For the moment,
some of them are more member of the European Union.
British here are not anymore.
Okay. She asks, European Parliament of D66, how can we understand the full impact of the digital information ecosystem and how it may be used for disinformation when companies decline to offer transparency to researchers, regulators, and representatives in democracy?
Right, so I happen to know that she agrees with me and that yes, there is a role for regulation. The difficulty is that, you know, these technologies are changing very fast. And what we don't want to do is create, you know, bad regulation that will, I mean, the regulation itself could also have negative effects. And, you know, you need to think of it, you know, as a dynamic process by which it will change over time. What I would like us to begin to do, and this actually I think is where our LSE project will eventually go, what I would like us to begin to do is to think about the internet in a broader way and think about what would a liberal democratic internet look like. In other words, we know already what an authoritarian internet looks like because the Chinese have created it. Very, very sophisticated ways. You know, they use many of the same kinds of tactics and technology as Facebook, but they use them to make sure that they have control over people. So we don't want that in our societies. So what do we want? What is the BBC of the modern era?
Yeah.
You know, what is the public information space? What rules do we want it to have? You know, should there be for example, in the space where we're having political debates, do we want to have anonymity? And if so, how much? You know, if someone were to walk into this room night with a mask on and to start shouting that he wanted attention, we would all be suspicious, right? We wouldn't necessarily want to, we wouldn't, who are you and why are you wearing a mask on your face? You know, online, people are masked all the time. And again, there's a long discussion about this, and of course there are many good reasons for that, and people like being anonymous online, and, you know, dissidents in difficult countries have been safe. I'm not saying there should be no anonymity at all, but should there also be spaces where there isn't any? In other words, where everybody takes responsibility for what they say based on their real names. That's one set of, you know, do we have digital rights as citizens? What does that look like? What exactly should we be guaranteed?
What could that be, digital rights?
Yes, for example, Estonia has something called a digital ID card. And so if you're Estonian, you can have, you have a sort of digital ID that you can use for all kinds of things online that shows that you're real. It's somehow connected to your person. And you can use it for banking, and you can use it for voting, and you can use it for, you know, conversation, all kinds of other things. In other words, as an Estonian, you have the right to have a kind of
digital passport.
A digital passport. That's a better word than ID. You know, maybe we should all have that. Maybe the European Union should give us digital passports so that we can all, you know, so that at least in some areas we all take part and we all have a safe, you know, some safe connections. So, you know, the other question is what do we mean by free speech in this new world? Because the model that when we talk about free speech, the model that we all have in our heads is Orwell's 1984, you know, where there's a minister of truth and they cut things out of the newspaper and they erase pictures, and you know, that doesn't exist anymore. The real problem, the real threat to free speech now is the one that we started out talking about, which is not the government erasing, you know, erasing things, although there's a bit of that still. The real problem is the flooding of the information space with junk and with false stories and or tangential, you know, very tendentious stories, rather. And so we need to rethink what we mean by free speech and think about how to protect it. Maybe we need, as societies, maybe we need some insight into the algorithms. You know, maybe we need, you know, maybe there is such a thing as a public interest algorithm. In other words, so what Facebook is trying to do when it, and I'm picking on Facebook, but this is true of all of them. What Facebook is trying to do is to sell stuff. You know, I mean, they created this machine that's perfect for selling whatever, soap, you know, or pop music, or, you know, and they, you know, identify people who like a certain kind of soap, and then that you get lots of ads for that soap if you, you know, if you, you all know this, I'm sure. And this turns out it works just as well for politics. You know, if you express an interest in left-wing politics, then suddenly you'll get lots of ads for left-wing politics or whatever, right-wing politics, whatever it is. You know, maybe there is a public interest algorithm that does something rather different, that shows you a range of things, or, you know, has. I mean, I'm making this up because I'm not a computer scientist.
But it sounds very intriguing. The public interest algorithm.
But there are computer scientists who are interested in this kind of problem and are talking about it. You know, I mean, in France, I know that there's a debate about, you know, shouldn't there be a kind of public ombudsman who's in charge of algorithms? You know, shouldn't somebody from the democratically elected, you know, government have some insight into how they work and to what they favor and what they don't favor. And that's the beginning, I think, of a much more interesting conversation about regulation. I mean, yes, I mean, obviously the idea that we live in a world where Facebook is going to have employ thousands of people, which they do, whose job it is to decide what gets on and what gets off the internet is wrong. I mean, that's, aside from it being inefficient, you know, why does Facebook get to decide? Or Google, you know, or anybody else.
Well, one of the problems is that we don't discuss this in economic terms. Maybe we focus too much on this technological part and don't address these economic powers that are driving behind this.
Facebook is doing this to make money. I mean, there's no, you know, this is...
And they're not even in Europe, so they don't care about our European...
They don't care about, no, legislation. Of course not. They're tangentially interested in Europe and European elections and European political issues, that's true. They are focused on the U.S. And, you know, let alone, I don't know, Burma, you know, or India, where Facebook and Instagram and other... and WhatsApp actually are used for all kinds of, you know, in nefarious ways. I mean, that's just not something that people in Palo Alto were thinking about when they designed the programs. So this, I think, is going to be the task for the next generation. The question is going to be also how to convince the political class, you know, politicians, to take this seriously as an issue. And it's very, you know, it's a difficult technical issue. I mean, we had maybe some of you know, there was an extraordinary... I mean, horrible, actually, moment when Mark Zuckerberg testified in Congress, and it was, you know, it was one of the most embarrassing things. That, you know, you could see that some of the people asking him questions, this was in the Senate, didn't understand what Facebook was or how it worked.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to, you know, we're going to need to have politicians who are educated in this stuff and who are going to need to understand it better, so that they will be able to decide. And as I said, I think at the end of the day, we should have some say. I mean, should the purpose of our news, you know, and information space, should the purpose of it be to make money for people in California, or should the purpose of it be for us to make sure that our democracy survive? I mean, there's at some point we're going to have to decide. It may be that this is something that ultimately has to be done by the European Union, simply because it gives you a louder voice. You know, it's not just the Netherlands. It's a much larger group of countries, maybe the European Union plus Britain. But I don't know. I mean, there
is so little interest in these topics from politicians, I think.
Yes, I mean, I think until they start losing elections because of it, maybe. But there's more interest in France. There's more interest in Germany than there used to be. There is a bit of interest in Britain, although we'll see where that goes.
I saw there was another question. Please. Wait for the mic and stand up.
Hi, thank you. Well, when we talk about the effects of disinformation and fake news, one of the things I find mind-boggling are all these parallels that we can draw between how it works in Eastern Europe and in Western countries. And in the light of these parallels...
What do you mean by Eastern Europe?
The former communist bloc.
The former communist bloc or the former Soviet Union?
The former Eastern Europe communist countries, so also Poland. Yeah. I have a background in former Yugoslavia, so that goes there as well. And in light of these similarities about, you know, how effective disinformation is, it seems to me that a lot of explanations we usually offer ourselves on how we make society resilient for disinformation, like, you know, oh, the problem is that the civil society is weak. Well, it's not in Western countries, or at least we didn't assume it is. Corruption is high, you know, but maybe in Netherlands it's not. So what can we make, you know, if all our explanations about how we make society resilient with strong institutions, independent media, you know, good education, etc., etc. We do have that in Western democracies, and yet it seems that it falls short as a kind of barrier towards this new wave of disinformation and fake news. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
So, yes, I think you're, I mean, I actually don't think there's as big a difference between, you know, Poland and the Netherlands as most people think. I mean, and you know, I've written a lot about what's going wrong in Poland, so it's not, I'm not under any illusion, but I mean, that Poland has been a democracy for 30 years, you know, you know, Germany's only been a democracy for 40 years longer. I mean, it's not, it's, you know, these aren't, but in the modern sense. You know, I don't think, you know, anyway, I don't see a big difference between the East and the West in that sense, but I think you're right in that the traditional remedies, you know, the things that we have thought would preserve our democracy, may in a lot of places, like the United States, for example, turn out to be insufficient. And it may be that the, you know, we need to think more deeply about, again, how information works, how we protect it, and also how we reconceive some of our institutions and ideas for this new era. You know, one of the other things that I think people don't like about modern democracies is that they seem outdated. I mean, I can click my phone and Amazon will deliver a pair of shoes to me tomorrow morning, right? But, you know, to create a government coalition, you know, in Sweden takes 6 months, you know, or for the bureaucracy to make a decision about some, you know, there's a feeling, you know, there's often a feeling that everything takes too long. The old conventions are boring. I mean, it may be that some of our democracies, some of our institutions need to be updated for a kind of digital era when things happen faster. It may be that some of our ideas about what civil society is need to be updated. I mean, we clearly need a kind of online civil, you know, we need online civic education, which we haven't had before. I don't think there are that many schools that teach, you know, internet etiquette. You know, how do you deal with a troll? You know, I don't, you know, that may be something that you need to learn in a classroom, and maybe it has to be part of understanding how to be a citizen in a democracy. I mean, that while we're thinking about updating, you know, making the internet suit us, we also might have to think about how our, you know, educational and judicial and political institutions also need to be updated to deal with this different ways in which information now circulates. And I think that's a problem for Western and Eastern Europe alike. I mean, I don't think it's that different.
But do you think that there would be a good idea to evolve towards an online democracy, a more fast form or?
I mean, for some things, for some things. I mean, I am not a fan of referenda because they polarize people over issues that, you know, may or may not be, and they create bad debates. But yeah, I mean, it may be that politicians need to use the internet more creatively to reach citizens. You know, it may be that, you know, maybe my, you know, my imaginary public interest internet will have spaces for debate and argument in which politicians participate along with ordinary people in new ways. I mean, maybe, you know, clearly the old ways of transmitting information, you know, through the television or in an interview or walking around shaking hands. I mean, some of that, will, of course, will have to go on, particularly the walking around shaking hands part. But maybe there also needs to be, politicians need to find ways of interacting online. I mean, actually, Twitter turns out to be not very good for doing politics online. Because, but maybe there's a, maybe there's another form of social media that is, you know.
This form of public interest algorithm, what would that require? What would be the requirements for that? Would it be
a lot of dedicated computer scientists? A project that involved, you know, lawyers and people who think about, you know, human rights in different ways, experts on free speech, experts on communication and politics. You know, it needs a needs to be a
moderation?
Kind of national.
Constant moderation.
You need a kind of national project to think about what it is that we want. I mean, yeah. I think we're just at the beginning of this conversation, but
we first should rethink the whole idea of this.
Well, the whole, you know, we've accepted the, you know, we've accepted the internet the way it is, because, you know, the way it was, you know, there are some flaws in the ways, I mean, for example, the fact that it was created to allow anonymity, that was part of the original design. You know, the fact that it's now very dominated by a few companies. You know, do we as, you know, I'll speak with my European hat on, you know, do we as Europeans want that? That's, I mean, leaving aside all the issues about Facebook's money and so on, this is sort of secondary. Do we want those companies to have so much power over our political systems?
They know us so well.
Sorry?
They know us so well already, so.
Maybe we don't want them to know us so well, but, no. But anyway.
I don't think we want to know us, we want them to know us so well, but they already do.
Yes, well, you know.
So we're a bit late, I mean.
We're a bit late. I mean, we've, you know, there have been attempts to limit the amount of data people can give away, yeah. And so on. I mean, but. And that's the beginning, that's kind of, that was the beginning, that was the first step. Yeah. That was the beginning of thinking about it. You know, now people do understand that their data is being used by these companies for, you know, but there may be another, you know, we need to take a few steps farther, I think.
And so now back to the role of journalism in favor of the truth or the facts or the information we as citizens need. Do you have some... How can we say that? Some ideas how we should transform journalism towards.
So there's an ongoing conversation about this too. Maybe journalism is also and by the way, it happens in newspapers. You know, maybe journalism also needs to be partly reinvented. And you know, you've seen some of this probably on Dutch papers as much as you know in American papers. You know, journalism. You know. Newspapers becoming sources of videos, trying to find different ways to connect with readers. In some cases, creating kind of clubs of their readers to you know, because one of the ways in which you create trust is by having a deeper relationship. So it's not just your readers clicking on your paper, it's also, you know, the paper or the magazine provides extra content for its members or something. I mean, there are lots of people are experimenting with this. They're also experiments with what's called, sometimes called constructive journalism. So journalism which isn't just people writing and describing the problem, but also focuses on finding solutions. It's very fashionable, for example, in Denmark and one or two other places. You know, is there, you know, I don't know, could you create an interesting television program which dealt with, I don't know, whatever, a problem, you know, potholes in the road? And you got the various actors responsible for the potholes, and you put them in a room, and you had them solve the problem. Or so, you know, and there have been, you know, the difficulty, of course, is how to do that without it being boring.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
just stating the facts, it's so.
Well, how do you involve people? How do you do journalism, which is about finding solutions and coming up with answers and fixing things, in a way that doesn't make people switch off and want to watch, you know. I don't know, the movie, something more entertaining. You know, how do you make that entertaining and involving? How do you bring people into a political conversation in a way that's not that's also exciting? But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of complaints about journalism, which are, you know, particularly in an era when newspapers and websites and even broadcast television have lost money because their advertising model has been destroyed by social media. They've lost money, and so they are more frantic for readers, and so they're more sensationalist. And as they become more sensationalist, fewer people trust them.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a kind of vicious cycle that, you know, you can see killing off newspapers because they become sensationalist, they make mistakes, you know, people don't trust them anymore, stop reading it, and there's a... And the question is, how to break that cycle? Is there a different way to do journalism? Is there a different way to do the news? Can you, you know, again, maybe there's a role for public broadcasters. You know, can you offer people something more than just, you know, a sensation? Can you offer them an answer, a solution, a feeling of connection?
But even public broadcasters have low trust, are undermined.
Right, so then the question is,
yeah,
how do you...
mainstream media.
Well, like the BBC we talked about. Yeah. I mean, so how do you... What should they do to rebuild the trust? And that's I mean, I think, you know, everybody who I know who's in public broadcasting is thinking about it. It's not and there's no obvious answer. I mean, if there were, we would have come up with it already.
I think we have the chief editor of Follow the Money in the room. There he is. He's reinventing journalism...
Very
in
good.
In his own platform. Yeah. Oh, there's the mic.
I'm the inventor. Yeah. Hi. Hi. I'm indeed one of the founders of Follow the Money, and actually I do not very much agree with what you just said about media.
So you agree or you disagree?
I disagree. I think there's you will see numerous initiatives that do show a complete different business model. For instance, our platform has no advertisements. Advertisers. It's completely subscription-based. It's long form. It's not about the headings or spectacular news. It's about investigative journalism.
Sorry, I didn't mean to imply that all journalism is going that way. I just meant some is.
As a matter of fact, you see a bit of a trend. I would see even in our bigger newspapers that have tend to focus more on in-depth stories. So I think there's a positive switch towards in-depth journalism, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The question is, is it enough? Because there's so much filth and diarrhea around. There's the small islands of truth that's surrounded by all that, excrement.
I didn't say that.
I have a question, though. Which is not about necessarily about journalism, although there's many questions to ask because, you know, you basically advertise writing about boring stuff in being a telephone book, just write the facts, you know. A telephone book is full of facts. It's very boring. I want to go back to that algorithm of the public interest because that fascinates me. I think the assumption is that there is a general idea what the public interest is.
What if
and you've more just less suggested that you know experts of many fields are supposed to be introduced or to help design the algorithm, but who's experts? On what side do you invite all the experts if there are experts? What is an expert? How can you legitimize the construction of such an algorithm?
What if you could construct an algorithm that reflected the views of the public?
Yeah, well, I mean, then we get back to the basis of a democracy, don't we?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean...
But that is still going back to what is factual or not. One expert can say this, but in the end, it's a discussion about facts.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I didn't mean to imply that, you know, expert... sorry if I was unclear. I mean, what I meant to imply was that we, right now, decisions about what we see and read are often made by, you know, people in large companies in Palo Alto. And I would like that to be not true anymore. I would like us to decide how we see and read it. And the process by which that happens... you know, I'm not dictating to you right now by any means. It's clearly something that should involve the public, and we should find a way to express the views of the public and include the views of the public. You know, But you will need some computer technicians involved, and you know, presumably there's some way of deciding who knows how to write an algorithm and who doesn't. So there's some level of expertise is required. But no, I didn't mean to imply that 10 people will sit in a room and design it. Although that is kind of how the BBC was designed. But yes, you know, I don't think we're disagreeing.
But it does show a sort of a very strong belief in the solution of technology in solving the problem. Am I right?
Well, technology has caused the problem. I mean, although it's not a problem. I mean, it's a change in the nature of information, which is good and bad, and it has allowed interesting publications like yours to exist, and it's destroyed some older publications, and it has allowed some people who we didn't hear from before to speak, and it has allowed some crazy people to speak. And this is not I'm not making a moral judgment about whether it's better or worse. You know, in some ways it's better, in some ways it's worse. But the point is, it's different. It's a new world. We have a completely new way of exchanging information. Now the question is, who is going to decide how that space is shaped in the future? You know, is it going to be Mark Zuckerberg, you know, or is it going to be us, you know, in some sense, people in this room or rooms like it? And my desire is for it to be people in this room like it. But since I'm talking about a process that hasn't begun yet, you know, you're asking me for details about it that I can't know. I'm not giving you a formula for how that's going to happen. I'm just saying I want it to happen. That's all.
I'm very disappointed.
Sorry?
I was coming here for the formula. But it has to be a democratic formula. Thank you very much.
Of course it has. I mean, that's the point. You know, the point of it is that we want a democratic formula that reflects our democratic values. That's absolutely the point.
But there's something in this algorithms that are working now that they are polarizing in itself. They are centrifugal in itself. They're fragmenting.
Yes. I mean, I don't know if you've all tried this experiment. You know that if you go to YouTube and you look up veganism, you know, and you start clicking on, and if every time you make a choice about a more extreme form of veganism, you will end up with, whatever you do, you end up with the most extreme version of whatever it was, you know. Or the same, you know, if you keep clicking on, you know, you can start with, you know, the far right and you end up with white supremacists and Nazis, you know. So if you, the algorithm will lead you in the direction that you're going. And that happens in any subject, not a political subject, anything. It will show you more and more extreme versions of whatever it was that you were looking for. So, you know, is that how we want YouTube to be constructed? So well, that's the only question that I'm asking.
Yeah. So maybe we can reshape an algorithm like that.
And by the way, when you're talking about it, I didn't mean to imply that all new journalism was going to be boring. You know, quite the opposite. I mean, I was in Jacksonville, Florida a year or two ago, where I was at a dinner where there was the editor of the local newspaper. And he told me that his newspaper, which only comes out in a print edition, I think it's once, I don't remember now, I don't think it's every day, it was once a week, I think, I'm just not remembering. But anyway, he has a print publication, which is the most important publication in Jacksonville, and it's only print, there's no internet, and it's very expensive, and it makes a profit. And he, you know, it gets delivered whenever, however many days a week, to all the citizens in Jacksonville who want it, and it thrives and survives and is very influential and people read it and so on. But it doesn't even have an online version. But if you want to know kind of really the inside on, you know, scoop on local news in Jacksonville, you have to buy this. And of course, the problem with his model is that it leaves people out who can't afford it. But
it serves only one side of the bubble.
But there are going to be many models of how news is distributed, and the people who are the most creative in coming up with these models are the ones whose papers will survive.
There's a question in the audience, in the middle, yeah. First, that one, and then...
Thanks. Okay, so we've been talking about what kind of solutions there are, but we don't really know yet, because it's still in the future. But I was thinking you're also an historian, so is there some kind of clues from the past, because democracy has survived so far, that we might use to do something with the solution?
That's a really interesting question, and we actually, at one point, we tried to do that. We looked at what methods had been used to fight Soviet propaganda in the past. What had been the responses that worked, and do they have a modern equivalent? Because obviously it's not the same. And one of them that I remember thinking about was, you know, in the Soviet Union, you had this, you know, very intense propaganda. You know, all the media was state-owned, and so how could you create an alternative to that? And there was a group of dissidents in Moscow in the late 60s, mostly 1970s, and then 1980s, who created something called the Chronicle of Current Events. And it was one of these publications, you know, that people typed up in their apartment, and you would type up five copies and then pass them out, and then somebody else would type up five copies and pass them out. And then very often a copy or two got to Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, and then the stories would be beamed back into the country. And this used to drive the Soviet government crazy because, you know, they couldn't figure out where this news and information was coming from. And the question was, why did people trust the Chronicle? So they would get these sort of bulletins. They were very basic, actually. They were sort of bulletins of basic information. And they were often information about who'd been arrested or who was in prison or what was going on, just kind of lists often. I've seen them. And the answer was, again, one I hinted at before, is that they'd created this community of trust. So people trusted the originators, they trusted the people who were distributing it. You know, they had a... So that made me think, so maybe one of the answers to disinformation in the present is also creating new communities of trust. And as I was hinting in what I said before, there are some newspapers, magazines, publications that have tried to do exactly that, you know, create a readership, you know, by having a relationship with them, or by having a particularly high quality journalism that, you know, giving people something that, you know, I'm a certain kind of person because I read this, or that sounds obnoxious, actually. I mean, but I identify with this kind of writing or these kinds of articles. And so that was one thought. The other was that there had in the past been responses to disinformation that came in other spheres. So, for example, I don't think we talked about this yet, there was a very famous Soviet-era, 1980s-era disinformation project, which was a project designed to spread the rumor that the CIA had invented AIDS. It's a very famous, very well-studied story. There's a book about it recently. The way this rumor was started was in the old-fashioned way. You know, there was a story planted, I think originally in an Indian newspaper with some kind of Communist Party links, and then they planted another story in an Italian newspaper, and then eventually in other places, and then people began picking up the stories, and it spread that way. And this, of course, is a project that took many months, I think even years, to catch on. You know, now this is something you can do in 15 minutes. I mean, you just plant stories in 100 different websites, and you know, you create a rumor and then you spread it with bots. I mean, it's very similar. So what, and then the question was, so what did the United States do about this? Because they were aware, the American government became aware that this was happening, and they were getting questions from all over the world. And there were a number of responses, and one of them was, you know, to put out, you know, disclaimers, and just like we have fact checking today. And another one was to tell the Soviet Union in diplomatic dialogue that if you go on doing this, you'll suffer in other ways. I think at that time there were these scientific exchanges with the Soviet Union. We will cut off these scientific exchanges unless you knock it off. And the only interesting thing about this is it shows how if you begin to take disinformation seriously in one sphere, and this is more to do with disinformation attacks, you know, from other countries, you know, you can respond in other spheres. So, you know, and this I think was what the Obama administration was thinking about in the very, very end when they saw the Russian campaign going on in the U.S. election. You know, if you do this, we will sanction you in these other areas. So you have to look for somehow responses in other places. And that was one other thing that we looked at. And then we looked at the creation of in the past of Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, and why those, and those were probably the most successful counter disinformation projects ever done. I mean, they were good news stations which, again, gained a reputation for reliability among their listeners, and which also, Radio Free Europe was important because everybody knows what Radio Free Europe was, right? So Radio Free Europe was important because it was Radio Free Poland or Radio Free Czechoslovakia would use local people. So Poles ran Radio Free Poland and Czechs ran Radio Free Czechoslovakia. And they, again, sought to create links with their listeners. And so, again, creating a sense that, they cultivated an air of reliability and simplicity.
It's about producing trust in your community.
It's about so ultimately, a lot of this comes down to creating trust. You know, how do we rebuild trust? How do we make sure that people don't feel excluded or left out? How do we rebuild that trust in a world where, there is a lot of junk information out there?
What's the question?
But it's a fascinating subject. I mean, there is no exact analogy in the past. I mean, when you look at what ended religious wars in Europe, well, it was like the Enlightenment and the invention of religious freedom. And I'm not sure I know what the analogy to that is.
No, and then we first have to start these religious wars.
Right. We would like to avoid the point of getting to religious wars.
Please go ahead.
Good evening. So for the last couple of years, we've been observing the whole process of the rule of law backsliding in certain member states of European Union, especially Hungary and Poland. And I was really curious about your opinion of the role of media in the whole process of undermining of judiciary in those countries.
That's a really interesting question. The first thing, the first clue that there was going to be a problem with the current Polish government was the fact that as soon as they could, they destroyed state media. Poland had a public media that was, okay, it wasn't what it should have been and so on, but it was meant to be a neutral space. And they took it over and they gave it to people who had been sort of on the, kind of far-right journalist kind of propagandists. And they changed the nature of it completely. And they made it a kind of ruling party media, so that it speaks, and it's not even really pretends to be anything else. And they created this very, very slanted, very biased media, which kind of openly manipulates and even brags about it. So I could give you lots of examples, but it's a long story. As soon as they did that, it became clear that what they were going to do was to try to, change the constitution and break the law. And this was the first role. And as in other countries, as in the U.S., you have had, on the other side, you have had independent media seeking to counter that, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. I mean, you've had, both in the U.S. and in Poland, actually, there's been an odd thing that's happened, which is that, independent media have kind of taken on the role of becoming the political opposition, which is not good for media. That's not really the role of media and of journalists, but people have become engaged, but they've had some successes. In Hungary, they've gone a step farther, and the Hungarian government has also sought to undermine independent media. And this has been done in a variety of ways, from denying or trying to limit advertising in independent media to altering rules to make sure, essentially trying to harm their business model and their financial model as a way to make sure they don't succeed. And now, in effect, almost all, with very, very tiny exceptions, almost all Hungarian media, I mean, this was a long process by which they sought to take over and undermine the independent media, and now the end game is that most media in Hungary is owned directly or indirectly by the government, by the ruling party. And again, that's been a deliberate, part of the policy, because, of course, if you control the media, then there is no level playing field, there's no marketplace of ideas, there's no competition. So it's been a very important part of in both of those countries, and actually not only there. I mean, I know that there are parallel things that have happened elsewhere.
But if we talk about the consequences of that, you wrote a quite moving essay about New Year's Eve in Poland in 1999, and now 20 years later, you say you would cross the street if you came across one of these former friends.
We would mutually cross the street.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you write down what became of these friendships of that time.
So this was a piece that was about, you know, what had happened to, you know, a group of people, the sort of Polish anti-communists, you know, who had been one united group in, you know,
at that time.
And have now divided very bitterly. And this is not a phenomenon unique to Poland. You can say almost a very, very similar process happened within the Republican Party in the United States. You know, I know I have Republican, many friends who don't speak to each other there as well. It's very strikingly similar. But so it was an attempt to describe how and why this happened. In some way, and, you know, the point of it was that in some ways there were sort of uniquely weird things that had happened in Poland that explained it, and in some ways it was part of a bigger story that you can see echoed in other democracies.
But it's all dispersed and your friendships are all dispersed.
So I have plenty of other friends, so it's fine. But
and then you wrote last week that before Brexit you organized a dinner again.
So I described in an article in the Brexit situation a little weird because I have friends on both sides of that debate and I have stayed friends with both sides.
Okay.
But they don't all like each other. So we thought, well, let's have dinner and we're going to invite people from both sides. And as I wrote in that piece, it wasn't that fun. And so you feel like a friend of mine said to me, well, I'm not coming to any party or any dinner at your house ever.
So you're not inviting them all together again.
That's right. No, but, in England, I've found it much, for a lot of reasons, maybe because I'm not originally English, you know, but I found it much easier to not lose friends over Brexit, but people have. I know it has been very polarizing, and people are pretty bitter, but depending on both sides, actually.
Well, I see there's a lot of questions, but we have to finish in a few minutes, and I want to ask you a few questions about what we can expect in the coming year, and then you can discuss.
I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't know who will win the US election.
Well, at the midterm elections in the United States, you wrote, we learned a lot about polarization and disinformation, and yet we learned nothing because we know how it works, but we don't do anything about it.
No, I mean, the best way to fight polarization is with an anti-polarizing political project, right? But what that means and how it works and who can succeed at it is not clear. And I can point to you little examples around Europe of people who've tried it. One of them, in a very small country, is the president of Slovakia, who won an election as a kind of in a where there had been a populist government for a long time, and she won, and very, very corrupt one, and she won an election as a kind of provincial green, kind of progressive religious candidate. That's my best description of it. You know, she kind of defied a lot of categories and became president of Slovakia. So that's defying categories and finding new ways of reaching a wider range of people is clearly one way to do it. But there is no magic formula. And others who've tried to, moderates are at risk of looking weak or old-fashioned, or of sounding like, I just want everything to go back the way it was. And that kind of politics doesn't win. That's, what worries me about Joe Biden, for example.
Yeah.
Even though, he'd probably be a perfectly all right president. But, there's a counter theory that what we need to counter, very polarizing right-wing populism is some very polarizing left-wing pop. You know, that what we need is a radical left, and that's the Bernie Sanders argument.
Yeah.
If you want.
Do you think of that?
Well, the one example we've had of that being tried, which was in Britain, was also a failure. So
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes. So, you know, it's a, you know, the we are in a time of political experimentation. I think all of our parties 10 years from now are going to look completely different. The people's political alignments are changing very rapidly, and I don't think there's a magic formula that can predict what will happen.
Is there any civic counter response you can endorse to us?
I mean, there have been, you know, there have been a lot of good civic responses. You know, in Italy a couple of weeks ago, there was a very interesting counter response to Salvini. If, I don't know if people followed this here. There was a local election in Emilia Romagna that he was very important for him, and he spent a lot of time there. And there was a group of very young Italians who said, all right, Salvini is the shark, we're sardines. You know, he's bigger and more powerful than we are, but there are a lot of us. So every time he showed up anywhere, this huge pack of sardines, they called themselves, would show up and protest and shout in the background. And that was, and they were funny, you know, and they were good at, you know, they were good at creating jokes and, you know, making fun of him. And they seem to have helped. First of all, they raised the interest in voting. This is just a local election, very high, and they had a very high turnout. And, you know, he was defeated, or his party was defeated, not him. So this is a, you know, this is an example of one. I don't know if that's scalable to a, you know, national level or not. I saw an Italian friend of mine yesterday who thinks it's not, but, you know. You know, there are a lot of experiments. There's an interesting Swiss experiment. There's a also very young group of Swiss, they were originally students, who created a project called Operation Libero, which was originally designed to kind of do counter disinformation. They didn't call it that, but that's what they were doing online. You know, they would sort of, they had a team of people who would, you know, when people wrote things that were wrong or untrue, they had a team that would go out and try and, you know, on these public fora and discussion fora, they would try and, they also sought to, you know, because there is a big Swiss populist party, which is their largest political party, and they sought to, you know, can't we read, you know, and the populists would talk about the Swiss past and the countryside and Swiss traditions, and they said, well, we want, you know, there's also another kind of Swiss past, and it's the revolution of the Constitution, rather, of 1848, and there's a long tradition of Swiss liberalism, and we've historically been open to the world, and those are the parts of Switzerland that we want to celebrate and remember, and you know, in other words, they were countering a kind of nationalism with a form of patriotism. This is another, you know, and they've been using it to fight these referenda campaigns in Switzerland. So none of these are kind of, you know, I'm not offering you any formula again, but
no, but maybe we should look for some locally rooted.
But there are, we're in a time of political experimentation, and we don't know yet what is going to come out of it.
Okay. Anne Applebaum, may I thank you so much for your stories and your insights tonight.
Thank you.
Please read her books.
Thank you.
She has to leave us very quickly because she has to go in the train very early in the morning. Please read her books. Follow her on Twitter.
But and don't troll me.
Don't troll her. And next episode of The Futures Now will be, I think, in April with David Goodhart. Thank you very much.
Thanks.